Support for WBFO and What's Next comes from our members and from Health Foundation for Western and Central New York, where racial and socioeconomic health equity are prioritized. Learn more about building healthier neighborhoods at hfwcny.org.
From Buffalo, Toronto Public Media, this is What's Next, an hour dedicated to amplifying the voices of marginalized and underrepresented communities across Western New York and Southern Ontario.
We cannot erase, we cannot reform, we cannot make things better if we're uncomfortable having tough conversations,
Absolutely.
If we're uncomfortable Absolutely. Talking about race.
What's Next carries forward our mission to engage in meaningful conversations about race, equity, and the shared concerns that deeply affect Buffalo's East Side and beyond.
Don't stop. Make those families part of your life. Their lives are part of yours. Don't stop.
Together, we dive into the real issues, striving for understanding, connection, and change.
In the suburban area, everywhere, we must work and teach our children.
Welcome to WBFO's What's Next, where we explore the pressing issues of our time with thought leaders and change makers. I'm Naila Ansari Cotillo, and today we're honored to have Dr. Kenyatti Davis. Hi, Dr. Davis.
Hey.
She's the Chief Medical Officer at the Community Health Centers of Buffalo. Dr. Davis is also a physician and a leading advocate for healthcare equity. Known for her work addressing disparities right here in our community, our conversation today centers on the future of healthcare equity and research, especially in the wake of recent federal budget cuts under the Trump administration. Welcome to the show, Dr. Davis.
Ooh, just that intro already seemed
I know,
good.
I got a little nervous.
I
know, it seems like every day there's a different blow,
it's
right, with these
different.
Federal cuts.
It's
and
something different.
You know, I think it's important to have this conversation because a lot of us don't actually understand how it affects us, particularly in healthcare. And
Absolutely.
It's a system that we all have to engage with. So let's start with the landscape. We're seeing these federal cuts that impact our programs like Medicaid, the Affordable Care Act, and community health centers.
Mm-hmm.
From your perspective, how are these cuts affecting healthcare access?
Gotcha. Is this where I put that whole disclaimer? This is my medical opinion.
Yes.
This is where I do this right so I can keep my job. I think to answer that question, the very first thing is to understand exactly what is Medicaid and what is Medicare.
Mm-hmm.
The truth is the CMS, which is the Center for Medicare and Medicaid, is the largest purchaser of insurance in America. Everybody thinks that we don't have this socialized system, but the truth is almost over 80% of it is purchased by CMS. So now let's take in, and I believe it was Lyndon B. Johnson who actually put in for Medicaid, and it runs around what we established our government on, which is give us your sick, give us your poor. We'll take care of them. Medicaid is actually a joint venture between the federal government and the state government. So the feds put up money and then the states match that money and they put up money as well. And that in return, that joint venture creates Medicaid. Medicare, however, is fully funded by the federal government. So when you talk about these executive orders and they talk about cutting in CMS and different things like that, they've definitely voiced that they're not going to touch the Medicare part of it.
Mm-hmm.
But like I said, you know, whatever day and time it is right now, I could leave the studio and it could be something different.
Right.
But to date, there was no knowledge of actually changing anything with Medicare. Remember, Medicare is 65 and over, or if you have some type of disability, people who have end-stage renal disease who are on dialysis, even if they're not 65, they can be on Medicare. But Medicaid has always been one of those things that people have always wanted to try and change or improve, if some people say, or, you know, dismantle, others may say. But Medicaid is really at the big forefront of this executive order. And the state in which you live in is very important because mm-hmm. how they support Medicaid is an important thing because those are people who people always think it's people who don't work, right? Sometimes it can be the working poor, people mm-hmm. who just can't afford. So when they did the expansion for Medicaid, under Obamacare, they expanded it to the working poor so that they could have insurance. Then when they wanted to repeal that, it left this large population of people, millions of people who didn't necessarily qualify for Medicaid, right? But they weren't rich enough to pay for insurance. So we call it an essential plan. So these people were kind of stuck in the middle. And that's the working poor. And that's what a lot of Americans fall under when it comes to their insurance. And these executive orders have really, they've really attacked that.
Mm-hmm. And it's interesting because we all don't know that. Like, I'm just now learning that states are involved in Medicaid.
Yeah,
in particular. So your state also matters.
Your state
in terms of your health care. Mm-hmm. And, you know, who loses this coverage first? Because like you said, we assume that it's a certain demographic of people, but it affects a lot of us.
It does. I mean, only this administration knows how they want to roll this out. But I can tell you who loses everybody, right? Because here's the thing. When you don't cover people, it eventually gets to you, no matter how you want to look at it, how you want to slice the pie. When you don't take care of your sick, you're hungry, you're poor, it eventually comes around. To be honest, we honestly don't know who it's going to be. I mean, I will say that, you know, everybody has their speculations, right? I can tell you history has demonstrated sometimes they try to put work restrictions on that. And the very first thing is you can't run the country like you run a business, right? I mean, it's very complex. Democracy is very, very complex. But let's say you want to tie work restrictions to Medicaid, right? Mm-hmm. Who's going to fill out the forms to say that the person can work or they can't work, right? There's going to be a pipeline somewhere where it's going to get clogged at. Who's supposed to do that, right? The healthcare that's already strained, that, you know, already diminished after COVID. Like, you got to think through some of these things. But my concern is that, honestly, the people who are going to lose, this is the working poor. And I think most people think it's the people who are on the system. No, I think the people who are going to feel it first is the working poor.
And they're going to feel it because we have been doing a lot of work now in this country for preventative health.
Yeah.
What does that look like now that we, you know, folk may not have insurance and they can't go in and say, hey, I'm feeling kind of funky today. Can you help me? And then you find out there's a deeper issue. They might not want to go to the doctor now.
Right. Well, I mean, people don't want to go to the doctors now already, right? especially, for some of us, it's real, right? Mm-hmm. You know, the raids and ICE, some people are a little nervous about coming out of the house and stuff like that, and, you know, and rightfully so. But my concern, though, really with the vaccines is that we've known for years that, you know, vaccines do work, right? There's a whole generation of physicians who wouldn't even know what polio looked like if it hit them in the face, right? We had a monkeypox outbreak, you know, a small outbreak a few months ago. But I gotta tell you, if you're not currently studying, you know, in school now, I mean, monkeypox is not rocking through your heads, right? Because of all these things that we've done from a really good public health perspective and managing diseases, being able to identify diseases before they even come to the, you know, come here to America. I mean, you think of places like USAID, right? They have other functions, right? Other functions of keeping diseases away from us or notifying us when things are kind of bubbling up in different areas and preparing the medical community to be able to identify and respond. So it goes a lot deeper than I think some people may think from a public health perspective, but vaccines are a big one. I'm not going to say they're going to be taken from you, right? Because I don't know what this administration is going to do. Luckily, you know, we've talked to our vaccine people and they haven't had any communications from, you know, anybody, and they're still going on business as usual, which is always a good thing. But like I said, you don't know. But vaccines, you're getting vaccinated, not necessarily for yourself, but for the person next to you to minimize disease.
It's interesting because this affects public health policies. We got RFK Jr. That's now going to be heading up our healthcare systems. And he's been avid that he doesn't really support vaccines, right? And so can you speak a little to that, of the importance of vaccines?
Yeah.
And how do we negotiate someone that's supposed to be our leader telling us one thing who's not a physician versus what physicians that have studied this work for a long time?
Yeah. Yeah. But, you know, like I said, I can come out of this booth and it could change. But, you know, we as public consumers of goods, we have a powerful voice. The problem with public health is sometimes you don't want to learn the lesson too late, right? And we learned that with COVID, right? We kind of learned the lesson a little too late. But we as consumers of healthcare, right, we can still demand, you know, quality. We still need to demand transparency, and we've gotten all that. But we also need to understand the scientific method, right? We don't have all the the answers, but every research article that comes out builds upon the knowledge that we have. But this is why I say it's really important that you have your primary care doctor and you're having these conversations with them, but you absolutely should be asking, you know, your clinician about your vaccine schedule. Are you up to date with your vaccines? Because remember, you're getting vaccinated for the next person, also to protect yourself as well, but you're getting vaccinated for the next person and hopefully to decrease your severity of your diseases. Because keep in mind, each vaccine does something different. Because that's another thing that happens in my office. They're like, oh, well, I got a flu shot and he gave me the flu. No, it didn't. You had the flu before I gave the shot, right? But the truth is some just decrease severity of disease. Mm-hmm. Some prevent you from having disease. Some prevent the duration of having disease. So I think those are very important concepts to understand, because I think people go into them and then they're like, see, well, I'm not going to get it anymore because I got it anyways. Like, that's not how it works. But now more than ever, you really need to start having conversations about your preventative health, because it may be a very different landscape mm-hmm. next year.
It's so interesting because I think we forget about the whole nation. I think we typically kind of live in our bubble, or vice versa. Some people only focus on the nation and not locally. But what are the consequences that you see for public health equity?
That the less fortunate and even the working class will become really sick. And you got to understand that they make up the majority of the people. You're right. We don't live in a globe. And I think this is something that people don't realize, right? We're not the only people in this world, right? So when viruses don't just stay in their one place, they travel because people travel. And now in 2025, people can travel a lot quicker, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, heck, we're going to the moon now, right? So, I mean, we're probably going to get space aliens in the moon today, right? But because of that, we have to be cognizant not only of what's happening currently in our backyard, but what's also happening adjacent to our, you know, to our partners, to our right and left, as well as on the other side of the world. Because as long as you have trains, planes, and boats that can move people from place to place, nothing can stay in one spot.
And I think that's interesting to kind of dive in a little bit more, because it seems like we are going backwards a little bit and that we're trying to not push the train forward, and particularly with innovation. And there's a lot of cuts being funded in terms of healthcare and research and medical research and medical advancement. Can you speak a little bit to that and how dire that is for us to not have that research?
Yeah, you know, let me start by saying the system's broken, right? I don't care who you are, red, yellow, purple, Republican, Democrat, nobody's going to tell you the system's perfect. The system's broken. The question is how do you define the problem and how do you start putting the pieces together to try and fix it? We have modernized medicine so much to the point where you can clone sheep now, right? Mm-hmm. But when you get so specialized in treatments, we were doing things like gene therapy. Like, let's start there, right? And I'm trying to figure out the most diplomatic way to answer this question, right? Rephrase the question again.
In terms of innovation, mm-hmm. with the budget cuts that we're having, say with NIH and the CDC, it's slowing progress, right? Yes. And what's at stake for the medical research?
Gotcha.
With these reductions,
gotcha. Everything, right? Because not only are we going to get this very super specific advanced innovations that come out, especially we're doing really cool things with immune systems and cancer research. These are all funded by a lot of times by NIH and different NIH grants. When you do research, there's two particular things to look at: the indirect cost and the direct cost. The direct cost is everything it costs you for the lab and to do the work, which is all really important things. The indirect cost are the things that the institution usually charges the grant to keep everything going. And when we're talking about these grants, we're talking about multi-million dollars grants. One person can't do the work,
right?
You know, write the grant, do the research. One person can't do that. You need really big structures and organizations to do that if you want to do it the right way. There's things, accountability is in there, transparency. Somebody has to do that. So these indirect costs, they can range anywhere from 10% to 30% of the grant to support the infrastructure needed to do all these really cool things. in the executive order, that was cut, right? Mm-hmm. And it was cut down to 15%. I hear the arguments on both sides. Well, you know, these institutions were making a whole bunch of money off of these grants, right? Others were like, well, listen, it takes a lot in order to, you know, to balance it. I don't know what the right answer is, but I can tell you that a lot of these, we call them R1 schools, mm-hmm. Which other ones usually know as like Division I schools mm-hmm. that are really big on research, is costing them millions. And when I mean millions, I'm talking like $50, $60, $70 million. That gives them pause, because then they have to realign what they're doing. And the only people that suffer is us.
Mm-hmm. And there was another dig to that, too. It's like, if any of these research grants that we're going for, that were in review process, no DEI,
yes,
right? So how do you do research without talking about race and gender and sexuality? Like, how does that, how is that possible?
If you don't want to tell the whole story, it's possible, mm-hmm. right? Because the truth is that when you start looking at, let's take some medications, for instance, some medications act a little differently in women than they do men, right? Mm-hmm. Not necessarily because we're all the way different, but we have different sets of hormones, right? So how does one medication work in this one when estrogen is a little higher, or when mm-hmm. testosterone is a little higher? Those are very, very important things. And that's more at a micro level. When you come up to a more macro level and you're looking at just outcomes of diseases or outcomes of procedural outcomes, you absolutely want to stratify it. And you want to stratify it because you want to be able to pinpoint where you can improve. So when you remove that out of the equation, so then how do you know where you're supposed to improve? We all think we're doing really good, mm-hmm. right? But the Institute of Medicine report that came in, you know, the early 2000s demonstrated that from the cradle to the grave, that in all possible outcomes, African-Americans ended up having worse outcomes from the cradle to the grave. So we know that we've got a lot of work to do. So I will say, in all honesty, rolling some of that back is a disservice to progression. But the other part, I got to say, not to go off topic, but for DEI, everybody likes to reduce it to race. Right?
Correct. DEI is so much more than race.
It's a DEI hire. What the hell does that mean? Mm-hmm. Right? But we do this in America. We reduce everything to race,
right?
And that's not it. DEI is paid paternity leave mm-hmm. for men. DEI is having breastfeeding stations, you know, for breastfeeding mothers. DEI is having a little more time off of work because you just had a child. Like, none of that is racial, right? DEI is some of the stuff that we do for veterans. Mm-hmm. So we don't care about veterans, right? We like to reduce it to race, and race is just a small part of it.
Which is interesting, because we talked a little earlier before we got started mm-hmm. on, and I'm still kind of jostling between the two, health equity versus health equality.
So
can you explain that a little bit? Because I think that will help folks understand it a little deeper.
Two totally different things, right? Mm-hmm. Equality is, we just make everything equal, right? So, you know, if I had everybody in this office, if I gave them a woman size 9 shoe, right? And say, listen, all of you guys got the same shoe, right?
Everybody should fit it.
Everybody should fit it, right? Everybody should be a woman size 9. People are like, well, what do you want me to do with this, right? Like, I can't wear this. Well, don't get mad. I gave it to you, right? So you can't say I made a difference. I gave it to you. But equity is actually removing those barriers. So it's taking a sign-up sheet. What size shoe do you wear? What size shoe does the next person wear? And I'm actually going to give them the shoe that fits them so that they can actually benefit and use it. So that's the example I use for my students when I'm teaching. Equality and equity are two very, very different things. At one point, we were pushing equality, right? Because that's where we were in life, is that we did not have things that were equal, right? Mm-hmm. Now we're at this point where now we have to look at equity, right? Because when you put equality on top of either racial foundations or racist foundations, you can't have equality on a shaky foundation. It's equity that you have to do, right? Mm-hmm. And that's what puts us in this push and pull sometimes, is that the foundation is a little shaky.
Right. And we see it predominantly right now. A group that's getting hit particularly hard are our trans mm-hmm. brothers and sisters, mm-hmm. right? Like, it's mm-hmm. it's becoming really difficult. That, I mean, it's quite literally the erasure of them, right? And they, like, to the point where we have to take the T out.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And I know that was what happened in higher ed, and yeah. I know it's also happening mm-hmm. in the medical field. What impact does that have on such a small group of people, but one that creates a huge impact for equity?
Yeah. You know, the thing is, even for us, we have a report that we have to run every year as a federally qualified health center, and we call it SOGI data, which is sexual orientation and gender identity. Mm-hmm. It is literally due February 15th of every year, and we got communication literally a week ago, right before our submission, right? That, oh, no, all that work you did in that table, take it out. We don't want it anymore, right? But the notion is just the thought that you can just erase somebody with the stroke of a pen, mm-hmm. right? And I put my own self, my own bias. I am a God-fearing Christian woman, mm-hmm. right? That is who I am. But I do believe that there is a separation in church and state for a reason, mm-hmm. right? I mean, I'm Christian, but I'm not trying to make you Christian, right? But
right.
I can live in the same world with you, right? And I think that's what makes us different than other places, is that there is a separation between church and state. I got into medicine because I don't want to be the judge, the jury, and the executor, right?
Right.
So I will profess, I just want to treat people, right? That's it. So it is a little alarming and concerning, because all that happens is, if we don't address the stuff on the surface, what happens is we drive it into the dark abyss. Mm-hmm. And when you drive things into the dark abyss, that's when it becomes dangerous. That's when people become preyed upon. That's
yep.
when the vulnerable becomes more vulnerable. That's when diseases emerge and different things happen, because people aren't seeking attention or help in the right ways. So I'm more concerned about driving things into the darkness.
Because violence is very real in the trans community.
Violence is real.
And I don't think that people really understand the effects of this erasure mm-hmm. across the board, mm-hmm. right? You know, trans folks have been fighting for a long time. We talk particularly Black trans women
yes.
that are constantly being killed or violated mm-hmm. in different ways. So it's one of those like, are we going backwards, or are we just doing this out of this idea of like Christianity, and we are supposed to be a very Christian nation, and this is what the Bible's saying,
yeah.
which it also says, love thy neighbor like
we
love yourself,
part.
Right?
We forget the part that, you know, that God is everywhere and God is love. But, you know, here's the thing. At the end of the day, it's church and state, right? I can believe what I want to believe in my house, mm-hmm. right? But it part of the democracy is, I don't get a chance to make you live the way that I want to live. The tough part about it, though, is that we're always stronger together, mm-hmm. right? And this is the problem with history, right? As I digress again, right? When you don't teach history, right? And when you want to change the narrative, you will always repeat it again,
mm-hmm.
right? The more we divide, the more we allow ourselves to be divided, the easier it is to conquer, right? We are one race of humans, right? And when we don't fight for each other's rights, we will lose our own. And I'm going to say that again. When we do not fight for the rights of others, we lose our own.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what the civil rights were, right? That's what Martin Luther King was marching for, right? He wasn't marching just for Blacks. He was marching for coloreds. He was marching for the working poor. Mm-hmm. He was marching for unions. Everybody was all okay with that until they decided to bring race into the issue.
Right.
Right. So that's how they dismantled it. They dismantled it with the smoke and mirrors.
Which is interesting, because the whole point of, I work in Black studies, right? And the whole
yeah.
point is to actually talk about how we need to deconstruct the idea of construction of race.
Right.
Right. Like, so the notion of this idea of we're trying to push DEI, it's like the whole notion is that we're trying to tell you that y'all made up race.
Yeah, that's not real.
It's not real.
And here's the thing. Newsflash. I mean, obviously, I know we're on the radio, but with a name like Dr. Kenyani Davis, I don't think you have to really figure out what I am. Google it. But the truth is, I'll be the first person to tell you, you know, are there some things with DEI that we can do better? Yes, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Right. But I always like to hear people's opposing arguments. Right. And one person said, you know, and it was a Caucasian male, and he said, listen, I don't want to sit here and hear about, you know, how bad it's been and how wrong people feel. He's like, because that just makes me feel bad. And I said, I had an aha moment. I said, wow, so your happiness is fragile. So your happiness is fragile.
Meanwhile, we all have to be in pain. Every underrepresented group has to be in pain.
And you know, and it's not his fault by any means, but it said, wow, happiness is, it's fragile.
So, but that's a privilege.
It's a privilege, right? So what does that mean? So is DEI the answer? I don't know, right? But more importantly in that statement, what I heard was we need to do a better job of teaching civics and history. Right?
I agree.
Because if we teach history, he wouldn't feel bad, right? He wouldn't feel bad while he was sitting there listening to facts, right? And so when I think about it, if I, you know, had to put my empathetic hat on, I feel bad for him also, right? But the truth is it goes deeper than that, right? If we taught history the right way and embraced the areas that we didn't necessarily do good in as America, instead of trying to rewrite the course, I don't think we'd have DEI.
Right.
I don't think we'd have DEI. I mean, look at what Germany did with the Holocaust and how they were able to move forward, right? They don't sweep it under the rug. I think that in our quest to make America great, I think we can learn from histories of other people, you know, as well. But I'm going to get off my soapbox and stay in the
lane. I like your take on Make America Great there.
But, you know, but the truth is, I mean, I do want America to be great, right? Like, I do, right? But it takes us being able to humble ourselves to say we can learn from other places and other people in areas that we probably just didn't do so hot in.
I agree. Well, we're going to head to break. And when we come back with Dr. Kenyatta Davis, we are going to dive more into the health policies and these federal cuts.
Did you know that Buffalo Toronto Public Media produces shows that earn New York Emmy nominations and awards, Webby Awards, Telly Awards, GLAAD nominations, and New York State Broadcaster Association Awards? Check out our award-winning productions like Compact Science, Compact History, Let's Go, Brave Spaces, Klein Hands Gift to Buffalo, and much more on the Buffalo Toronto Public Media YouTube channel or visit WNED.org. This is Public Media.
You're listening to What's Next, our place to discuss the important issues of our communities of Western New York and Southern Ontario. We want to hear from you. Click on the Talk to Us option in the WBFO app, and we will work to get your questions or comments on the air. Do you have a story or concern that we should be addressing? Email us using whatsnext@wbfo.org. Together, we'll have the conversations that are needed. This is WBFO, your NPR station.
Welcome back. I'm Naila Ansari-Cotillo, your host for WBFO's What's Next, and I'm here with Dr. Kenyatta Davis.
Yes.
And she's been schooling us on healthcare and federal policies. I feel like I'm in a course learning all the things that I need to learn right now.
Thank you.
Before we went to break, we talked about the erasure of trans folks and underrepresented people, mm-hmm. particularly with some of these DEI initiatives and funding mm-hmm. that's being cut for research in the NIH, as well as the CDC. And what can you tell folks that are coming in that feel like they are being erased or that they aren't able to get the care that they need because our federal government isn't seeing them?
Yeah.
What can you tell patients to do when they find themselves in that position and they want to get help?
Yeah. You know, that you don't have to hold this on your shoulder by yourself, right? We're stronger together, right? And I think that's the thing. It's a small minority voice. And here's the thing, the voice may be, you know, louder. You just got some people who are afraid to say it. But at the end of the day, we're stronger together. And I always go back to kind of the civil rights movement. It wasn't one alone, right? It was one through a common shared interest, and it was one through strategy. And this is where we are stronger together. So if you feel that you're not getting what you need in one place, you absolutely would have everything in your own right to go to the next place, right? We're definitely in an economy that is very dollar driven, and your dollar matters, and you should choose where you want to spend that dollar.
Yeah. And I think a lot of folks don't necessarily always feel like they have a choice.
Yeah.
And I think that is, you know, even the work that we're doing here today is providing people with the resources and tools and the education.
Yes.
Which brings me to my next question about rural communities.
Oh, man.
Overwhelmingly, although people might have not may have not thought that they were voting this way, what do these communities that have seen a huge spike in terms of voting for a Trump administration. But there's a lot of folks now that are like, well, I didn't know you were taking away my Medicaid. I didn't know all of these things. And what can we do? Because a lot of folks are like, oh, you know, well, you know, they deserved it. They voted and they should have known. But a lot of people make the assumption that people are more well-read than they really are.
That is so true. So I got to tell you, a few weeks ago, there was a patient. It was my PA who saw the patient who came in and was talking about how great this administration was going to be. And you know what? And listen, that's her prerogative, mm-hmm. right? I take care of all kinds of people, right? And she kept going on and on and on. And my PA said, you know, you're at a federally qualified health center, right? Right. And what does that mean? Federally qualified health centers are ran through the HRSA, which is Human Resources Services Administration, under CMS. And we are mandated to take care of everyone. Doesn't matter whether you're poor, whether you're overinsured, underinsured. We are mandated to take care of you, right? Mm-hmm. And that it's usually a bipartisan policy. Everybody loves FQHCs, right? We take care of the population, and we're in rural America, inner cities. We take care of the population that nobody else wants to take care of because they can't make money off of it. So she's going on and on. And so my PA reminded her, like, you're at an FQHC, right? She still didn't get it. Then she couldn't afford her medications. And we have a program called a 340B, mm-hmm. and it's for people who can't afford their medications. Because some of these copays can be up to like $700 if you can't afford them. And these are like, we're not talking about the medications that are very rare. We're talking about diabetes medications,
right.
Things that people, blood thinners, things that people need in order to survive. Well, she couldn't afford her medications. So we used our 340B program. And it still didn't click to her, right? That these executive orders threaten everything that's keeping her alive. But mm-hmm. she held on to the fact that this administration was going to replace it with something better. That's not the time or place to kind of get into the push and pull. But the only thing that I can offer that lady or any other people, you know, who are in that way is that it needs you to be a little more well-versed mm-hmm. in the things that help you get through your day-to-day. And you'll be very surprised at how much of it is federally funded. And that's the thing. If that's the political party that you align yourself with, that's totally fine. I tell people all the time, I'm actually from a red state. I'm from a John McCain state, I would say. I'm from Arizona. It doesn't get any more red than that, right? And tend to be pretty conservative myself. But if this is how you want to align yourself, I need you to be very clear about the policies that affect you. Because what you can't do is then turn around and be like, oh, well, you didn't want to give me the service. I'd love to give you the service.
But we can't.
But my hands are tied.
Like, we can't fund it.
Right. That's how absolute and finite a lot of this stuff becomes. There's no real gray area. It's just like,
And I think that's the difficult part that a lot of people are trying to manage is like, we actually don't know how much the federal government funds, including private organizations, right?
Yes.
Like, this is not, I think everyone just assumes it's like SNAP benefits and WIC, right?
Yeah.
And
nope.
the Department of Education is like, oh, okay, we don't know that that's school lunches for people or that's people's financial aid, like Pell Grants. We don't understand how much the federal government not only helps out, you know, folks in our local mm-hmm. community, it helps out everybody in every framework.
Everybody. And keep in mind, the federal government is really subsidizing rural America. Those hospitals that are in dire need. I mean, the insurance companies can't keep foot in the bill for that. So a lot of those grant subsidies in rural America are specifically from the federal government to keep them open so that you can have choices and options in where you want to live. You know, I always laugh, you know, because my husband loves the whole country, you know, landscape and stuff like that. I'm like, listen, where is the nearest Target or shopping mall? Like, I don't got this to do, mm-hmm. right? But people should have choice. People should have absolute choice where they want to live, right? But that comes at a cost, right? A lot of the places, especially in rural America, with people migrating out of there, they don't have the tax base to support themselves like that. That money has to come from somewhere.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's something that we don't really understand is that it affects us in these little microscopic mm-hmm, ways. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the example of, you know, the federal workers were fired and the nuclear staff, and then we have to bring them back because we didn't know that they also managed weapon stockpiles.
The gag.
Right. It's like the gag. Whoa. And so all of these back and forth, you know, even when the initial freeze happened, like Medicaid was frozen. Medicare was frozen. How did you all manage to deal with that, particularly at FQHC, Federally Qualified Health Center? How did you all manage when those freezes happened?
You just go home and go to bed. You just go home and go to bed. There's not anything you can do. No, I mean, it was panic. It was panic and chaos because the things that you normally do. So even when we talk about grant drawdowns, we're on a cycle on when we can draw the money down. And you just put a halt on that, right? I mean, for us, we have about 200 employees, right? Other health centers have about 500 or 600 employees, right? We're talking about not just providing services to people, we are our own business economy itself. So we're talking about jobs. We're talking about jobs in Western New York. We're talking about jobs in rural America. You're laying, my mother just retired from the federal government, 40 years of a brilliant, wonderful federal servant, right? And thank God she kind of retired before that, but she was truly forced out before that because she saw the writing on the wall. And I got to tell you, people who work for the federal government, I mean, there's, I grew up in this world. Some of them are some amazing individuals, right? And they really are there for service because they could go into the private sector and work, you know, make a whole lot more money, but they're choosing to serve the public every single day. And then you have your bad actors in everything, right? But I don't know if we've been too fair to them because you're right. We don't know all the things that they do, right? And that's the problem. This is why you can't run an economy like a business. Right. You don't get a chance to just freeze it and say, all right, we're going to wait and send everybody home and then figure it out and bring back.
Right, because like, the whole ecosystem functions, it doesn't stop.
It doesn't stop, right? So that's what makes this really, really hard. And like I said, kudos to the old school, you know, Democrats, Republicans, independents, conservatives, and everybody who used to do this work, you know, years ago. This is how difficult it is, right? It's not as black and white as we all thought it was.
What, as a provider and working in a clinic, a federally qualified health center, what are your patients saying they need right now? I know mental health has been totally, everyone is just like, I can't watch this, or I'm watching it too much, or every day I'm like sick to my stomach because I don't know if it's going to be me, or I don't know how this is going to affect me. What are you seeing with some of your patients? I know for us, we have the DACA students, but for you all, you know, you all serve a huge refugee community, asylum seeker community, immigrants. What is what has the patients really been coming to you with?
People want answers, right? They just want to know how this applies to them. What's next? And that's hard because, like I said, I can tell you on Tuesday and on Friday, it could be something different. People wanted to know if they're going to lose their Medicaid. We have a family planning department, and people want to know, can I still come here, you know, to get my care? That's a hard thing. I even have a friend in Louisiana who she filled a prescription for a person and was like, here's your meds. But, you know, if, you know, Medicaid goes away, you will be paying $414 for your medication. And her eyes went like this. And she was somebody from rural America who voted, you know, for this administration. Like I said, I don't care who you voted for, right? I just need you to have an understanding of what that means for you. So people just want to know, like, they just want to know, how is this going to affect them? And because there's so much complexity to it, it's almost hard to say, well, okay, well, today it's covered. Tomorrow, I don't know if it's covered. And the other thing is, private entities, even insurance companies, they follow suit of what the federal government does. I don't think we realize this. We create a precedence. And if we get it wrong, we give corporate America the ability to follow suit as well. And I think that's the thing that I'm also the most concerned about as well, is because if we do something to either to limit Medicaid or further limit insurance coverage, people are going to emerge at the hospitals, right? And that's a really high cost of care. That will financially break a system. It doesn't matter how much money you save, quote unquote, prior. They're all going to reemerge at some point. The cancer is going to hit the emergency room. The stroke is going to hit the emergency room. The heart attack is going to hit the emergency room. all things that could have either been prevented through timely screening that were once covered by preventative care, was once covered by all the insurance. It was mandated that they cover it. And all the way to like maybe something as simple as just if somebody took the baby aspirin,
mm-hmm. right?
You know, they wouldn't have had the stroke. So I'm concerned that the cost of care is going to go up because you tried to save a few bucks, you know, on a Tuesday.
Right. And is it really saving long term? Right?
Exactly.
Because the cost of bowering each day is, you know, this is more than
right.
you laying off all these, you know, federal workers. Do you see any hope for our communities for the next 4 years?
I do. I do. Because I think when you lose hope, you lose your ability to fight. Right. I do. I think more importantly, the question is now, what is our ask? Right. You know, we've got to learn that I fight for my neighbor so that I can protect myself as well.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's the biggest message, is that we do have to have some type of understanding. Granted, you know, money doesn't grow on trees. Right. So mm-hmm. you have to find a way to patch the holes, but the music can't stop while you're finding ways to patch the holes. I mean, I work at a federally qualified health center. We're all in a really tough predicament right now, right? A lot of us rely heavily on these grants to take care of patients that other people won't take or can't take, or will be upside down losing money on. And if we went away, I don't know where these people would go, right? And when you think about it, if you want Western New York or any place, wherever you're at, to thrive, you need a healthy workforce in order to do that,
right?
To attract businesses to the place. So I'm really concerned that we are going to widen the generational wealth gap, the educational gap, and it'll be really hard to close that back.
Yeah, as I think we're a resilient group of people.
Yeah,
I think we've historically shown that.
Yes.
But we have to keep the fight going.
Yeah.
That we come first, the people come first, right? And particularly in healthcare, we don't necessarily get the choice to decide, oh, I'm going to help this person.
Yes.
I mean, you all take an oath on that.
Right.
And seemingly it feels like some of these policies are actually making you go against your oath.
Yes. Oh, it absolutely is. That's the conundrum, right? Is you take the Hippocratic Oath to take care of any and everybody, and then you have things that kind of come down that make you say, wow, this isn't the oath that I took. And kudos and hats off to my OBGYNs right now.
Yes.
They have been in the lime, the crossfires and everything. But at least I can say in my practice as a clinician, what helps us to get over these really uncomfortable conversations is honestly listening, right? Not listening to respond, but listening to understand.
Mm-hmm.
And I always tell my students that I teach, there's no such thing as a non-compliant patient. It's one that you haven't met where they're at yet.
Mm.
And what that means is that people don't just not do stuff just because they don't want to, right? I mean, some of them do. But part of it is I have to understand on a human level what's important to you and what drives your motivations. And if I can get to that, then we can come up to a reasonable compromise. And that's the second part. It's the great compromise. And I think we all need to sit back and listen, right? And not just listen to each other, like I said, to respond, but to understand where the commonalities are. Because when we have the commonalities, then we can create the plan.
Mm-hmm.
And that is what I feel like we're not doing. And some really great programs are at risk because they're caught in the crossfire. Some really great things that we've been doing will halt, like the research, some of our flagship universities, you know, our colleges that have been instrumental in moving us forward. And when you start to threaten that, then how do we remain a country that's great, that leads everybody else in the world?
Well, I'm going to come back to some of those points because it's getting juicy. We're going to go take a break. I'm Naila Ansari-Cotillo, and I'm hosting today for What's Next on WBFO.
We at Buffalo Toronto Public Media take pride in bringing you your favorite national programs like Fresh Air, All Things Considered, and Morning Edition. But what makes WBFO so special are its local programs, learning together about how government works in bite-sized pieces on Compact Civics with host Corey McCants.
Here's a quick guide on polling locations. A polling place is where you cast your ballot during elections. In America, the term polling place refers to the building, while polling station refers to the specific room or area where voting happens.
And diving into pop culture and local happenings on Group Chat with host Bentley and a revolving panel of friends in the know.
I really miss having to actually wait to tune in for a show and be there at the certain time. Like having to run home and like turn on the TV at a certain time to like watch your show.
Yeah, like more national unity then too.
Yes.
Like we were
because
all
you know,
tuned
everybody
in.
Is watching at the same time, and you can like call and
ever
say,
since
"Did you see
streaming,
what
happened?" Streaming, it's just gone downhill.
This is Public Media.
You're listening to What's Next, our place to discuss the important issues of our communities of Western New York and Southern Ontario. We want to hear from you. Click on the Talk to Us option in the WBFO app, and we'll work to get your questions or comments on the air. Do you have a story or concern that we should be addressing? Email us using whatsnext@wbfo.org. Together, we'll have the conversations that are needed. This is WBFO, your NPR station.
Welcome back. I'm Naila Ansari-Cotillo, and I'm hosting today for What's Next on WBFO. And I'm here with Dr. Kenyani Davis, the Chief Medical Officer of the Community Health Centers of Buffalo, and she is schooling us.
We solved world peace.
We solved world peace, hopefully, right? And I want to come back to where we were, you know, finishing off that last segment on maternal health. You talked about OBGYNs. We already have a high rate of birth mortality. And, you know, in terms of preventative health, we can also maybe argue that we might see more deaths as well if we aren't able to provide some of these programs and healthcare systems. Yes. Can you talk a little bit more about maternal health, OBGYNs, and what are these some of these cuts in policies doing for women particularly?
Yeah, I've got to give this in 8 minutes. This is a tough one, right? So when we talk about maternal mortality, and so that is anybody passing away during during childbirth and post delivery, right? Well, within the year. It's not huge numbers, but it's the systematic difference between who dies and who gets to take their baby home.
Mm.
And what we've demonstrated is when you look at those systematic differences, Black women, such as yourself and I, we have a 3 to 4 times more likely not to be able to come home, right? So what does that mean? That means somebody lost their daughter, somebody lost their wife, somebody lost their sister, somebody lost their mother. When we talk about some of these thought processes that are going on about quote unquote late term abortions, a late term abortion is a planned pregnancy that went wrong.
Right.
Right. A late term abortion is somebody has to make a really, really tough decision that I pray to God nobody listening ever has to make. Mm-hmm. Right. And there's not one physician who's ever made that decision and took it lightly.
Right.
At all. Right. But when we continue to indoctrinate people with these fallacies, what you end up doing is you widen some of these inequities, right? And remember, we talked about equity versus equality. Inequities, which is the opposite of equity, they are always avoidable and they are unjust. So things that used to not be inequities will absolutely become inequities, right? But I'm very concerned that by not drilling down to some of these conditions, that things that were inequities, like maternal mortality for African-American women, that will start to increase. Other things that used to not be issues will now become issues. Because once again, when you drive things, even things like abortions, right? I mean, abortions didn't come around, you know, in 1999,
right?
Right. I mean, abortions have been around forever, right? They just moved from, you know, a Planned Parenthood or a hospital. Mm-hmm. They moved from, you know, the back alley corner, you know, from the lady who used the hanger, right? Like, I mean, it's we act like this stuff is new, right? It's not new. What we did was we said, listen, you're already going to do it. You're just going to do it. So let's find a safer way to do it right. So that you don't become a casualty, because in that particular time, you were having a really, really tough time and you made this decision that you felt was right for you and your body at the time, right? So I am concerned about the disparities widening.
What do you think about bringing in partners, educators, community mm-hmm. organizations together to be able to help this fight? Because everybody's getting it from all different angles.
Yeah, because we're all looking at the same thing through a different lens.
Correct.
Right? So it's the same thing about looking at the total elephant, but we all got this separate piece, right? If social determinants of health, it's 80% of the totality of somebody's health, that means that everybody who's listening, you have majority of the piece of this pie than me and my medical community, which mm-hmm. means we all have to band together. So even developers say, well, what do I have to do with this? You need somebody to buy your properties, don't you? You need somebody to rent your properties. You need somebody to come in there. Like, if we don't have a healthy workforce, if people are dying or people can't afford X, Y, and Z, I don't know what you're developing.
Right.
Are you developing for the 1%? Because there's only so many of those. Right. So we all have to understand through our lens what this looks like. And that's the only way that we're going to be able to move the mark and know what we want to ask for. And once again, we have to listen for the commonality to know exactly what we need to ask for.
What are some publications? I know people talk often about resources and tools, but there's a lot of misinformation out there.
Yeah.
And I do know there's access to different medical journals and things like that that people can get. What are some of the ways in which folks can really educate themselves on what's happening?
Yeah. And you know what? This is where you got to find a buddy and a mentor now. You know why? Mm-hmm. Because when you talk about these executive orders and what they've done, some of these places that were trusted resources had their website scrubbed.
Right. Right.
Right. So people don't realize that. So some of the things that the CDC, the data they had on HIV and sexual practices and all this is what we use, us as researchers used to help formulate and educate and create a story. Some of that stuff has been scrubbed. So what that means is now it's a free for all. So the first thing I would say, Facebook, X, all wonderful platforms. I mean, we've all used mm-hmm. them. That's probably not where you should get your news, right?
Right.
And if you do see it, right, you kind of have to do a little more digging to see, to see if it's true. But this is closed mouths don't get that.
Right.
So if you're not having these types of conversations, you know, if you don't know what the trusted panels are, if it seems pretty skewed, one-sided, it's probably not a trusted, trusted source.
Because you don't know what you don't know.
You don't know what you don't know.
And I think that's something that we all have to do better is help educate everyone around us.
Yeah.
Because so often it is the, you know, I had a family member that was on Facebook. Did you see that? You're not supposed to eat this. Or, I mean, there was a big, you know, there's a Netflix movie out right now on alternative medicines that were actually killing people with cancer.
Jesus.
Right. Because people went down this rabbit hole of someone really just lying about it.
Right.
Right. And so people can find themselves getting very much in propaganda, really.
It is. And what happened was they broke the trust first, mm-hmm. right? They broke the trust first. And so that creates a vacuum and people are hungry for the void. And you're right. It is very, very important. I mean, at the end of the day, you got to trust somebody, right? But I always say that at the end of the day, the rigors of the scientific method, it may not be perfect. However, it is an exact science. I can reproduce it every single time. But start with your doctor, right? Mm-hmm. And I always say, you know, people say, come in for your checkup. I tell my patients, come in if you got questions, right? I mean, so if you saw the Netflix series on alternative medicine, let's talk about it.
Right,
right. I mean, we have to reimagine and re-envision how we utilize the experts in our life.
Mm-hmm.
But you got to be careful. You really do. And information travels so fast now.
Yeah.
It's hard to
extremely
keep up.
Fast. And
right.
you don't know what's truth versus what's not,
right.
Especially younger generations, because they usually haven't had another access point to understanding anything but from the internet. Right.
Right. Like, they don't know what it's like to go to the library with the Dewey Decimal system and try to find the book.
Sign out your library with your library card.
Exactly. They don't know what that's like.
Well, what is one piece of advice that you can give to folks that are listening on staying strong, resilient, and finding joy through these difficult times?
Yeah. Sometimes you have to just turn off the news, right? Because sometimes it can be too much, mm-hmm. and you can always pick it back up. But through these times, I would like people to remember that there are more things that we have in common that separate us. And if you continue to look for the things that separate us, we will continue to do the stuff that does not feed us. Mm-hmm. In my years of practice, I have learned that we have more things in common. I have more things in common even with people that I don't like,
right,
than I may want to agree with, right? But the truth is that we all love, we all care about our families, we all want to try and do our best. And those are true statements. Mm-hmm. So why would I think that anybody else would want something different? So that's what I would say. And always, to my other people who feel like they're just, you know, in a lot of despair, your only job is just to wake up tomorrow. Mm. And that's all you got to do. Just wake up tomorrow. Just make it through today and wake up tomorrow.
Mm. I love that. Thank you, Dr. Davis, for sharing your insights and unwavering commitment to healthcare equity.
Thank you.
You've been listening to What's Next on WBFO. I'm Naila Ansari-Cotillo. Stay informed, stay engaged, and remember, healthcare equity is not a privilege, it's a right. So until next time, take care.
Support for WBFO and What's Next comes from our members and from Health Foundation for Western and Central New York, where racial and socioeconomic health equity are prioritized. Learn more about building healthier neighborhoods at hfwcny.org.